Welcome to Thinking Aloud, a podcast about the nexus of politics and all those things that make us human. From the Lindenwood University College of Arts and Humanities, I'm your host, Don Heidenreich. Popular media often depicts some college degrees as less valuable than others, particularly those in the arts and the humanities. One such degree that often gets scorned and derided in the media is art history. But I can say from personal experience as a political and military historian and an Army intelligence officer that I have found my art history experience to be invaluable. Here with me today to continue our discussion of the importance and value of art history is Dr. James Hudson, professor of art and design at Lindenwood University. Thank you for being here.
Glad to be here.
In our previous discussion, we really finished with the idea of how someone becomes Michelangelo. How do they become these revered characters, especially since, as you had mentioned, so many of them have eccentricities that make them fascinating characters. And one of the things you said is that ultimately this happens through time and propaganda.
You become that. And that's the same thing with Michel Foucault's definition of the author. It's the author function, is that a Michelangelo, if it's the painting and we don't know it's by Michelangelo, it has basically no value. But as soon as we assign it and it takes on the author function of being from that artist, like the recent Leonardo da Vinci's that were discovered, then everything we know about that entity is then encoded and imposed on this object. So, oh, now it's really important. It's really significant because this great mind did it. But it's all kind of a fugazi and a hoax. So if you look at how we construct greatness, another great example is Linda Nochlin's famous article now, a great first-generation feminist art historian, is why are there no great women artists? And the whole point of that is an incendiary statement, but of course she's pointing out the notion of what do we mean by great? So great is a construct. And that's what we've done since then, is break that construct down. So a great artist, by the way, of this definition throughout Western civilization, up until we get to new art history, the feminist movements, postmodernism, they're always going to be a white male European artist, generally Christian, that is seen to have extraordinary technical abilities and intellectual ability. So all of that requiring a certain amount of education, which women weren't allowed to have. So they couldn't actually go to the same studies, go to the scuola, go to the atelier, go to the academies that the men could go to. So it was this notion of great is in itself, just like the author function, a complete made-up thing.
Were there significant women before the 20th century that we should know about?
Oh, yeah. Now that's one of the major studies. So we're past the third wave of feminism in art history, but it's still one of the most popular topics that my grad students really seize upon as well. And they love, for instance, Artemisia Gentileschi. She was an incredibly successful painter in the early 17th century, overshadowed her father, didn't have technical training. She was barred from life drawing classes. But as her example, she worked for the King of Naples. She worked for the Pope. She worked for all of these high-ranking officials. But you have people like her, Sofonisba Anduswola. You have, I mean, we could just go down the list. The problem is they weren't in the original biographies and the story written by men about how did we get here? Who were the great artists? And we should say by significant, what we generally mean in art is twofold. And so to be significant as a work of art, it doesn't matter if it's a banana, a toilet, or the Sistine Chapel, it has to comment on what has come before it, build on it, and be novel and move ahead. And then you have to have people take on elements of that invention, that innovation, and it has to spread. So to be significant, you have to do something new, and other people have to also follow suit and take note of what you've done and be influenced by it. So that's significant. But significance and influence is also often discussed as a billiards game. So when you hit a cue ball and you hit one of the balls you're trying to hit, you transfer the force, but in turn, the cue ball is also going to be impacted. And so the force is going to move in two directions. So every time we have one artist that's going to be influenced, that changes the way we look at the influencer and the influencee. So we have to discuss them differently at that point. But yes, there are daily new women artists that are being discovered.
You mentioned the new Da Vinci's, because I have to admit, I know little about it.
Sure. So the most recent ones that we have, the Salvator Mundi was sold at auction. Previously, it was Francis Bacon, and his triptych was the highest grossing work at auction at Sotheby's, like $64 million or something. But more recently, the Salvator Mundi, or Christ as Savior of the World. So you have him doing his blessing of benediction alone, probably from the school of Leonardo, and not if you look at the scholars. There's only 16 works that Leonardo finished that people agree were by him. He notoriously procrastinated. If you want a psychological case study, he is a great example. So again, he had, instead of historically Michelangelo with daddy issues, he had mommy issues. He never married, never showed interest in women. He was charged for sodomy several times in Florence. And so he would always start projects and then abandon them. Just like his Last Supper, the Sinfonia della Grazia in Milan, started it, left it relatively unfinished, and then went back and experimented with oil paint, started flaking off. So we often find new works that were just laying in plain sight that experts or AI or different types of new technologies coming out may connect imperceptible differences that we wouldn't see to other works to actually allow us to positively identify or attribute a particular work to a famous person. Here's another good example of that. Once that work became identified as a Da Vinci, its value shot up 1,000-fold. Art inherently has no meaning. So art has a cultural value, and it's only the cultural context and what we assign to it is why it's worth $20,000 for a banana that's going to rot. So it's because the idea behind it was so genius and that we care about now. But another famous example that also ties into resurrecting the importance of women artists is Vigée Le Brun, for instance, a late 18th century contemporary of Jacques-Louis David, was a famous and very accomplished portrait painter and a woman. So one of her paintings was previously attributed to David, and they talked about it having all of these masculine attributes and how important it was, and it was valued very highly. Then it was proven that it was actually painted by a woman, and immediately the value drops. It all of a sudden has these feminine characteristics and qualities, that etc. So the function of the artist and the work as well are intimately tied to the perceived value that we have at that particular point in time. And at that time, David trumped Le Brun. So
are there artists out there that you believe that people should be paying more attention to in what they can tell us about both history and culture?
Sure. So you'll notice that, and this is a contention among the Black and African American community as well, because we normally point in art history and say, oh no, we include these other perspectives. Look at the Harlem Renaissance. Well, that came out of the North, and so the culture in the South feels very left out. So one of my students actually right now is doing a study on a guy named George Hunt, who was a painter and a blues musician in the South. But the stories, what you really need to understand history and experience and stories in general, are the different lived experiences of different types of people with different perspectives. And so absolutely, we have any of those that we're just now starting to hear about, the Latinx culture, which so you have a lot more studies coming out of the Southwest and the West in the U.S., more of those voices and experiences of Hispanics in America. But also, we don't have a lot when it comes to modernist Asian art or modernist African art. I mean, especially in Africa, the story was that if you look at a textbook of African art, it doesn't really start until the 19th century when you have most of European settlers coming and actually taking those artifacts and discovering Africa. So the art that they make themselves was treated as something that's interesting that tourists might buy. So, but not serious art and not a tradition of its own. So we've discounted lots of different types of artists in different areas, but certainly, just starting off, if we want to look at American art, starting off with the traditions of Hispanic and Black artists in the South and Southwest. So we don't have a good representation there.
So what might be done to expand that?
Well, that's what we're doing now. So what expands that is, first, you're either looking at past artists that were significant, but you generally don't know about these past artists until you look at current artists and then discuss their influences. So looking at those that are exhibiting, going out, it's way easier now to discover new artists because of the internet, social media, the metaverse, etc. So you're able to see virtual exhibitions now in VR, or if you want to experience that on the desktop. So you can find different perspectives and great art much more easily. But the next step, of course, is going and learning about that artist, interviewing them, writing articles, writing up critiques of their work, making them known. And that really comes with building up, you know, a body of publications and scholarship around them. And then eventually writing a monograph on them, which legitimizes them. But then that leads to opening up the door to others that influence them or others that are in that particular realm of influence.
So there's a real level of investigation that gets involved here. It really is more than just pick up a book, look at a piece of art. It really is getting in and investigating where this came from, why it came from there. So in these new areas, really we're just now in many respects drawing the lines backwards.
Yes. So you don't know what you don't know, which is a very famous axiom that I hold very dear. So you don't know what you're ignorant about. So unless you go out, we can't just randomly find something that we don't know where to look for or how to look for it. So now, just like anyone who would do research into provenance, that being, where does something come from? Who is it made by? Where is it from? Who owned it? So you have provenance research. You also have the same type of research that historians would do. If you want to learn about a famous historical figure, you go and talk to them, or if they had passed on, the next best thing, people that knew them. So their children, their grandchildren, their spouse, etc. It's the same thing when trying to create or contextualize the significance of an artist. That's why interviews with artists are the best evidence we can possibly have, and that's why letters from dead artists are also the best evidence that we have. Of course, taken within the context of the meaning at that particular time and any particular considerations when it comes to how they might have distorted the truth in order to make themselves look a particular, which is a great example with Hunt. So my student that knows him and is investigating him is, in her words, he lies about everything, but constructing this persona, this mythical persona of himself, it tells you a lot about how people want to be perceived and then a lot about the culture that created it.
Yeah, it's one of the things I tell students about memoirs is that I find them very valuable, but I always remember that even when somebody's trying to be absolutely honest, there's always going to be a level at which you are presenting yourself in the best possible light, even in a bad situation.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, it sounds very similar, and I admire getting through all that.
Are there ancient artists or artists from the Renaissance and Reformation
that really deserve a little bit more attention in the modern world than we're giving them?
We have, honestly, in the last 30 years, we have a good, substantial body of scholarship when it comes to women artists in the early modern era. So we're doing a good job there. What we're not doing a good job of is artists of different gender identities and sexualities and ethnicities beyond European. Those are what we need to continue investigating. So the Egyptians, we got plenty of research there. The Greeks and Romans, what we have less of are producers of work outside of the mainstream. And we don't know who many of them are at this time. Most of the work that we have, for instance, from ancient Greece are leftover broken pots. That's most of the painting and then architecture. But the artisans, if they weren't a named artist, which was not common, most artisans and craftsmen, especially women through the Middle Ages, Jeffrey Homburger did a great job of his study of work produced in nunneries by nuns throughout the Middle Ages and how that was completely anonymous and why it was looked over. But no, that's a great question. So moving forward, it's going to be about doing further investigation. That's why I remember moving across country for like the 12th time, as you were discussing, you were doing. And the movers look at me and they're like, why do you have so many books? So it's history, right? It's already happened. We don't need to keep writing it. And that really kind of drove home this idea that people honestly think that you can write one treatment of, say, the history of the U.S., and then that would be it. So that's all we need. But look at what's been happening and reconsidering certain things in the narrative that we were given even when I was in school 40 years ago, seemingly now. And so everything keeps changing. We keep learning new things, but most importantly, the questions we ask keep changing. So just like Linda Nochlin asking the question, why are there no great women artists? Even, that was not even a consideration. So all of the academics were all men. They were all of European descent, and it wasn't even on their minds. They wouldn't have even thought of it. So we need to then look at doing more of these investigations. And people also say, well, why? What's the point? Because they tell us more about who we are and where we are and how we can get to where we want to go. So and only hearing one person telling the story, you're not getting the full picture. And that's why we keep revising history texts.
One of the things that I think is really interesting about art up until particularly the beginning of the 19th century is, as you mentioned, kind of this focus on individuals with resources mm-hmm. who are generally being painted. So
yep.
Are there artists who do give us, though, some feeling for what life is like for people who were not on the wealthy end of the scale?
Sure. So you mean earlier versions of getting glimpses into everyday life? Yes. So from antiquity, if you teach any classical myth class that involves the visual arts, the best, obviously, we write about our experience. And most of the writings that have come down to us are from the perspective of men generally, not domestic perspectives. And also wealthy men and educated men. So that's a vast minority of the population. So if you think back, the domestic information that we have from the lives of women, because they lived separately in antiquity, you have the man side side of the house, you have the women and the child side of the house. And then ritualistically, once a boy becomes a certain age, he then will move to and leave the feminine side, becoming a man. So there's different realms of experience that we have. But to learn what that was like in either side, and even for those that were not affluent, we have a lot of the best examples come from pottery from antiquity. So because they're used in a domestic setting, so they often do contain a lot of very straightforward, candid representations of what people were doing, how they made food, how they prepared it, their sleeping arrangements, sexual orientations and activities. I mean, you name it, you got it all there. If you move into the Middle Ages, that really comes, really interestingly enough, in manuscript illuminations and marginalia. So if you just go Google marginalia, because you'll find some of the most, if you like Monty Python, so some of the funkiest Monty Python cartoons that you're going to see there, everything from nuns picking penises from trees to people riding nude rabbits that are also simultaneously having diarrhea. I mean, it's all over the place, but it also has relatively straightforward and candid experiences of those that were doing it. And so they generally were monks and scriptoria, etc. So that's the perspective that they have. So we don't have a lot of those common ones aside from the cultural ephemera that we have from nunneries. So that's another good example. Moving into, if you want to know what everyday life was like, it gets really tricky because you have genre scenes that are very popular in the North, starting as early as the 15th century. You have Albert Altdorfer and others that really start the tradition of landscape, what's happening out in the real world, but what city life is like. So later on in the 16th century, of people like Bruegel, for instance, who are doing paintings of peasants and peasant life and dances and weddings, etc. And so we did think that examples like that were fairly straightforward and believable examples of what life was actually like. Since then, that's been criticized in that, for instance, Bruegel is an affluent, upper-class, relatively wealthy guy who is really disparaging, or some scholars have said, kind of making fun of these peasants going off and urinating in the woods, you know, if they drink too much, or getting drunk and falling over with a red face. Ha ha, look at them. Kind of a moralistic interpretation. So most genre scenes, they look straightforward, they look like it's real life, but the best examples of real life we have honestly come from quick sketches that artists will have, and postille, for instance, in Italy. So where they'll be sketching, say, a beggar, or sketching someone that's around town. That's the best snapshot we have of what real life was like.
We know that with European art in particular, in the Middle Ages and even into the Renaissance, that religion was a significant portion mm-hmm. of what was being done. Is this a common theme, though, around the world, or yes. is this really specific to Europeans?
No. 98% of the world's art is religious. That's a fact. So if you look at the pure quantity, the type, the variety, it is for a religious purpose, function, or generally for a religious function. So either to allow you to communicate to a deity as part of a ritual or a religious service, the sacrament, I mean, the Eucharist, I mean, any number of things. So 98% is religious. That's number one. And by religious, we also mean bringing in notions of pantheism and of nature worship and of creating something so that the universe will also protect you and that you're one with it, etc. So asking the favor of the forces of nature. So we're including that as well because you're trying to influence something supernaturally. But interestingly enough also, if you want the definition of art, 60% is in Italy. So of the UNESCO World Heritage Sites, still 60% is in Italy. And you ask yourself, why is that? As certain civilizations tend to create art at different volumes and for different reasons. And so if you look at art clustered and why it's Italy, it number one is the epicenter of the Roman Empire, who had immense resources, and thanks to a large slave labor thing and technological advances that they took from every civilization they conquered, were able to have these huge infrastructure projects and have art everywhere. But then who takes over that collection? The papacy and the Catholic Church, who also is going to be highly invested in using art to communicate doctrine, dogma, and propaganda. And so you have, in any single Catholic Church could have upwards of several thousands of individual works within them. So those two taken together, you have this clustering of what we call art. But in the rest of the world too, if you look at Buddhist temples, Shinto shrines, if you're looking at mosques, you're looking at mausoleums. So all of them. Yeah, so even if you're looking at Chinese scroll paintings or those of the literati, for instance, it still has a spiritual dimension to it as you're going to be going out and being one with nature, or in like Zen Buddhism, so you can kind of short circuit and get to the infinite and this other spiritual realm more quickly. So yes, it's not just the Western tradition.
One other thing that interests me, you mentioned 98%. Mm-hmm. So what's the other 2%?
The other 2% is the banana pasted to the wall. So the other 2% happens almost exclusively, just like think of dog breeds. So how many dog breeds were there prior to the 19th century? About a dozen, maybe. So all those purebred dogs, we really started genetically modifying them in the 19th century. So it's around the same time. So around the 19th century, what you have that started in the Netherlands, that's where you have the first middle-class economy kind of really burgeoning in the Netherlands and the Dutch East India Trading Company, which everyone's familiar with because of the Pirates of the Caribbean. So they started growing a more robust middle class who could afford art and wanted art to decorate their homes. So you had kind of an open art market instead of a bespoke kind of a situation in the rest of Europe, to where you would have a pope or a ruler wanting a massive painting or a sculpture or a building. Instead, you have people working, I'm going to crank out 3 still lives. I'm going to make 3 genre paintings, and they sell them for the open market. So those still have a lot of religious symbolism infused in them. If you look at even the flower paintings like Rachel Ryush and others that are in the St. Louis Art Museum, so everything has a different meaning. So a flower will represent the sorrows of the Virgin or represent Christ's sacrifice, or a fly is going to represent death and the notion that we're going to die. The flowers are us. They're beautiful for a short time and they die. So all of these, the same symbolism is just moved from a crucifixion scene to a still life. So you fast forward, we shed ourselves, especially in France, as you go through the revolution. And remember that France is the capital of the art world from the 17th century onward to World War II. So during the French Revolution, the monarchy was associated very closely with the church. And so when you overthrow the monarch who was put in place by God and supported by the Catholic Church, you have a rather anti-religious sentiment that kind of goes along with it. So you do have the Restoration, they do bring the church back and all that, but it's in France you have more of this kind of secular type of art that's developing, and that's where you get things like the Impressionists. So you don't have a lot of religious interpretations when it comes to people hanging out, drinking absinthe in bars with Degas or others. That's just their scenes of everyday life, seemingly straightforward, but trying to capture the uncomfortable and changing notion of modern life, that tomorrow there's going to be a new technology, something shifts, it's going to be new, and we're off to something else, and it's jarring for people at that time. So the last 2%, to answer your question, has really been the last 150 years.
I think you touched on this at the beginning with talking about the Netherlands. So when do we move into this idea of more art for...
art's sake?
Well, more art as a commercial thing.
Ah!
And when, you know, the idea that someone would create art knowing that it would be bought by somebody maybe like me and hung in my house. Mm-hmm. It's not going to a museum. They'll never see it being worth $1 million.
Yeah.
But does this kind of grow out of the development of the middle class in the Netherlands?
Yeah, that comes out of the Reformation. So in the North especially, you don't have nearly as many individuals that can afford that type of art in the South, you know, to be frank, in Spain, Italy, you know, elsewhere. But this growing economy because of the Reformation and the separation in certain areas of church and state, so somewhat, you're going to have this idea that people want to buy things for their homes, but of course it represents their values. When I ask my students, when you think of art, what does your grandmother like best? And it's usually like Monet's water lilies or something they have, you know, above their couch at home or, you know, in their bathroom. So when you think of art being produced that doesn't necessarily reflect your values but is used primarily for decor purposes, that comes out of the salon tradition and then the demise of the salon and the rise of your individual art galleries. And that's really 1870s in France. And then that spreads. So for instance, the salon were government-sponsored kind of events that showcased the great things that France was doing all the way through the middle of the 19th century. But you couldn't buy any of it. So you go there and it's an event. You go there, it happens annually. It's a place to be and be seen. You're like, oh, look at all this. This is amazing things. But you could get a pamphlet, and if you wanted to know more about an artist or buy their work, it had addresses for their workshops, their atelier. So then you could go there to do it. But still, it's not really designing for decoration that we would understand or appreciation. That comes about really with like the Impressionists. So the Impressionists actually rent out Nadar's studio, which is the famous photographer in the 19th century who famously photographed all of the stars, the starlets, and the most famous people at the time. So they rent out his studio and start having their work shown. And then you have the dealer critic system, which is very interesting, coming out of that to where, in a very shady way that we still see happening today, kind of funny you bring that up, is you actually have collectors that would go in and buy all the Monets or buy all the Renoirs or buy all the Degas. And then they would pay critics to write up reviews about how awesome they were, thus driving up the value, and they controlled the supply. And so they could then price it however they wanted in their own gallery. So the Durand-Ruel gallery is the most famous example that made the Impressionists rich. So Durand-Ruel is going to be a famous gallery owner in Paris. And so he sets up this system that we still really use by Sotheby's and, you know, these other auction houses today, where it's, look, it's the Salvator Mundi. It's really important. Here's why it's important. Let's put the value up at $160 million, and then we'll go from there.
I'd like to finish on the note that you actually kind of led to, and that is the idea of art for art's sake. Where does this particular concept come from?
Sure.
Since
I don't think we see it much in the ancient world.
No.
So where does it develop?
It develops, honestly, out of the aesthetic movement in England, so in your backyard for your specialization, from individuals like Ruskin, who are going to be, interestingly, in France, just like Art Nouveau, they would say art for art's sake or art pour l'art, and then to sound more exotic, you would switch. It's going to be in French in England, but it's going to be in English in France to make it sound exotic. But that's the aesthetic movement. And what they did, interestingly enough, it led to a famous lawsuit that we still can understand today from Whistler. So everyone knows Whistler's mother, so that famous painting. But Whistler actually made a nocturne, which was basically abstract explosions of fireworks. So, and then he sold similar works to a patron who then took him to court and sued him and said that this could have been done really quickly, therefore it's not worth the money that he charged me. 50 guineas, for instance, is what he charged him. And it's not art because it doesn't depict anything, etc. So this is the famous court case which bankrupted Whistler, but really is the test case for art as we know it today. The judge came back with, and the defense was, does music have a particular content that you're tying to it? Does it show anything? Does it represent anything? Is it talking? Is it conveying meaning in a particular logical, rational way? And their argument was no, music can just make you feel a particular way. And they're thinking of classical music, obviously. So just like music can make you feel happy, sad, anxious, mournful, so too can an abstract painting. So the fact that it can make you feel, regardless of the subject and regardless of it showing anything or teaching you a moral value or anything else, is important in and of itself. And that's really the culmination of the argument of Kantian aesthetics. So you know Kant, who actually separated judgment of things logical from things that are aesthetic and beautiful. And it states that something is beautiful if you're disinterested in it, if it is not tied to money, and it, once again, is not based on something logical. So it's the rose is a rose is a rose from Shakespeare. So it's beautiful because it's beautiful. I like it because I like it. It can make me feel a particular way, and it doesn't have to say it or mean anything.
Well, thank you so much for your time. I do appreciate it. Hopefully we'll come back again and have another conversation.
Oh, great. Thank you so much. Glad being here.
And we'll be back soon.